Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me out, be the biggest little flirt. Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual. And it's another Monday evening. This is the Shame Free Zone. I'm your host, Veronica Monet. I have a very special treat for you tonight. I'm going to be catching up with a very good friend of mine. We've been friends now for about 20 years. Go way back to San Francisco, our activist days for the sex worker rights movement, et cetera, a lot of ways in which we connect. And I'm talking about my very good friend, Christine Beattie. She's got a brand new book out. It's called Not Your Average American Girl. And that's the understatement of the year. So, Christine, thanks for joining me in the Shame Free Zone.
Thanks for having me, Veronica. It's a pleasure to be here.
How's the book going?
It's starting slowly. It's right now, you know, the economy is pretty much impacting everything, but it's moving steadily, and everyone that has read it has been gushing about it. I mean, I practically need a towel when I talk to somebody about the book, and I'm not just talking about my mother either.
So. Well, you know, Samantha Miller and I were pouring over your book just about a week ago. And we were you know what we were doing? We were looking for any references to us. Of course. We're like, where are we in this book?
Well, actually, I do mention Samantha by name.
I know you do. It was like what? Like a page or two about Coyote.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mentioned Coyote several times. You know, I first heard about Margot St. James, you know, the founder of Coyote, when I was this little 15-year-old boy in high school, and I was reading the San Francisco Chronicle, and there was a story about Margot St. James and this union for prostitutes, and I thought, I just finished the reading Xavier Hollander's The Happy Hooker, you know, not too long before, and I thought that was just the coolest thing in the world. And
yeah,
little did
yeah.
I know, I was going to eventually end up being a prostitute or a woman, for that matter.
Yes, or a woman. I actually was watching I think Margot St. James on the Phil Donahue show when I was about 15, so that's funny. But funny that
it's
we were
good,
both.
I think it's a good age, you know. To
I remember thinking, who are these uppity women? Who I mean, they're not ashamed. I just didn't, you know. But I was completely fascinated with the idea that they would not be ashamed. And of course, the people in the audience, and Phil Donahue, everybody's trying to make them like, you know, oh, aren't you ashamed of yourself?
No, not really.
And you're not particularly self-conscious either, are you?
In a word, no.
Well, you know,
I'm a shameless exhibitionist is what I am. But
oh, come on, you stole that from Carol Queen. So, you know what, I want to read a paragraph from your press release on the book because I just thought it was so well done here, and it's very tantalizing, so... Okay, so the name of the book, Not Your Average American Girl, and here's a little blurb about it. Set mostly in the purgatory of San Francisco's Tenderloin District, her story guides readers on an intimate journey through the subcultures of hippies, strippers, soldiers, urban transsexuals, prostitutes, addicts, jail, skid row, and finally, recovery. Ascending against all odds in her career, she is also a pioneering rock musician, a controversial journalist, and a survivor of the worst pandemic of the 1980s. Told with the unflinching honesty of someone with nothing left to hide, the humor of a survivor who discovers silver linings in the darkest clouds, and the spirit of a rebel who refuses to be broken, diabetes is a tale of sublime pathos and triumph of the human spirit. She proves you can't keep a good woman down. So what is? But this is not your first book, right?
No. My first book was called Misery Loves Company, and it's a collection of short stories and poetry that's also autobiographical. If Not Your Average American Girl is a feature film, then Misery Loves Company is the trailer.
Ah, okay.
I decided early on that, you know, after I'd gotten passes from several literary agents regarding the book, and they both pretty much said the same thing, I realized I was probably biting off a little more than I could chew with a full-length book, because this is right around the time I started writing, you know, as a regular contributor to Spectator.
Right.
And I realized, you know, I should probably start smaller than a full book. And so I wrote Misery, which is, you know, it's a collection of short stories and poetry. And that gave me some practice for, you know, writing a full book.
That's right. You did have a column in Spectator magazine, which was originally the Berkeley Barb and has now disappeared, like so many magazines and newspapers. It's pretty well gone, as far as I know.
The internet
done killed it.
You're
aware of some kind of online version? Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's gone.
No, well, there was, and I guess the people that publisher Kat Sunlove and editor Lane Winkleblatt turned it over to, I guess she was having some problems making a go of it as an internet version, and eventually it just sort of fell by the wayside. It was really sad to hear that, because Spectator and I go way back, because I used to advertise in there as a prostitute back in 86.
I did, too. I remember, I don't know if you remember Nikki. Nikki and I worked together, and I remember one time after a coyote meeting, she and I had conspired to run photos of our face in Spectator magazine, and that was just unheard of, except for the pro-doms and the transsexuals. They always run their photos, you know, with the face full on. But all the escorts were running their faces basically, you know, hidden, either blacked out or hidden by a scarf, or they pull their hair over their face. And I think... I can't remember exactly what I was doing to obscure my face, but we both looked at each other and said, let's do it. If the trannies can do it and the pro doms can do it, we can do it. And so we were like the first to run. You know,
if you don't mind me interviewing you for a second, what was your rationale for hiding your face? Because everybody else was doing it, or were you?
Well, it was just what everybody else was doing. So. You know, I think we were afraid we might get arrested. That was a big part of it, trying to avoid arrest. But you know, at some point you realize that this was a big complaint, even though, you know, you think that your clients are interested in your body and don't probably care that much about your face. Such was not the truth, you know. They really did want to know not only, I think, what your face looked like, but they just wanted to get a sense of your personality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you a happy person, a grumpy person? You know, do you look kind or mean? And if
exactly.
You don't, if you're hidden, you can't really communicate anything about your personality at all.
Well, the eyes being the window of the soul and everything.
Absolutely.
Well, that's one thing that kind of surprised me when I first got into prostitution. I was amazed at how much time I was spending just talking with these guys. You know, they didn't want to just get laid. A lot of them wanted, you know, someone to talk with. So I was sort of like a quasi therapist, a lay therapist, a confessor. I think that was probably one of the more gratifying aspects of that job, is I really felt I was giving them something more than just sex.
You know, when I go in and talk about the sex industry to college students, and I was actually just at Sonoma State University last week, I talk about, you know, how sometimes, and you can correct me because you know something about the streets, and I've never worked the streets, but I think sometimes the complaint for street prostitutes would be that these guys want to talk and, you know, wish they'd just kind of shut up and get it over with so I can get on to my next client because money is, you know, time is money.
Mm-hmm.
But for the girl who has gotten herself an apartment and is taking clients in her apartment, it's kind of immaterial what happens during that hour because they're going to pay for the hour regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, it's if they want to fill that time up talking, okay. But I think eventually what one learns about men who pay for sex is they are very much looking for companionship. And I know it took me a while to understand that. I certainly, it wasn't intuitive for me. I thought, I kind of bought the stereotype about men that they're all after one thing and it's just sex. And nothing could have been further from the truth. I remember one client, he was a young man. He was younger than I was. I was in my 30s, so that would have put him in his 20s. And he got very irate when I tried to initiate some kind of sexual activity. And he said, I just want to talk this time. And I remember thinking, okay, I'm sorry. You can keep your clothes on.
Well,
did you ever
have situations
like that, Christine?
Oh, well, not where they got indignant, you know, that I was trying to get to it. I do remember the first time, and I talked about this in the book, too, when I had I was one of the first trans women. We don't like to say tranny. It's some of us in the community regard that as kind of like the N-word. I mean, you know, it's like...
Oh,
yeah, you learn something now. It's like it's because it's so often used as a put down. It's like, you know, one straight woman says to another, "Oh, you look just like a tranny." You know, it's used as a put down and sort of a dehumanizing word. So, trans women is the
after
PC.
After all my years of activism and being a sexologist, I'd know this, but I don't.
No, well, it's now you do.
Yeah,
I kind of use it. I'm not quite as uptight as others, but I try to put that out there. Just
mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'd like to spread that around because some people won't even think about it. But, okay, so getting back to the point I was trying to make, which I'm desperately trying to forget. Well, that's right. something I got to early on, I was one of the first trans women to run a calling card ad in the Spectator because they just started those. And most of the trans women were just running the classifieds. There weren't too many that were running photo ads back in 86. And the first one I ran was with a partner that I had who turned out to be this total whack job, like dope fiend, total nutcase. And eventually I had to show her the door. And so I was still getting, because the photo ad was both her and me, I was getting calls for sugar and spice. And I'm saying, look, you know, this just sugar, spices no more.
Spice
until I realized I need a new ad.
Right.
And so I needed someone that could take a really good, decent photo. And my stepfather was a professional photographer. I couldn't ask him to do it. So I got my ex-wife to do it.
Oh, wow.
That was a trip. So the very first, to get back to your question now, the very first outcall that I got from my new ad was this, a guy out in Livermore who just gotten his tax refund check. And normally, in Livermore is a pretty far drive, as you know, from San Francisco. I said, look, you either got to pay me time and a half or have me for 2 hours to make that worth my while. I said, well, if you for 2 hours, no problem. And I thought, like, oh, God, you know, it's like 2 hours of marathon sex. Oh, well, you know.
Right.
At least I get out there, and the guy's like, it's this really great Chardonnay and some really good pot. And we talk for like an hour and a half. I'm just on a sofa, just sipping Chardonnay, having a wonderful conversation. And finally, I was like, look, you know, we've got about 20 minutes left here, and I'm leaving when 2 hours is up. So, you know, he wanted a blowjob. I gave him a blowjob. It took like 10 minutes to get him off, and we had five more minutes, and I was out of there. And it was $120 an hour. So I divided 10 minutes into $240, and it worked out to $720 an hour.
It's not bad, huh?
Yeah, I thought, God damn, what did I go to college for? So.
Well, I don't know about you, but I certainly used my college degree in my writing.
Well, I'm just I was being facetious, but it was like, damn, you know, this is pretty good money, and I was just talking. It's like it was great.
I actually got put on a $50,000 annual contract for just to talk. All this guy wanted to do is come over every Thursday for 4 hours and watch old John Wayne movies, order takeout, and then fall asleep on the four-poster bed that he'd bought for me. He completely furnished my apartment.
I'm so envious.
I don't know. If you'd had to listen to these stories... You know, you have
for
to listen
$50,000, I think I can listen to a few stories.
Yeah, for all that. I mean, you know what? I bought a house. That went towards my down payment.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah, I got audited for that. No. Pay your taxes. That's all I can say.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
let's throw in a little bit of activism right now. If prostitution were legal like it should be, then it would be like any other job in that, you know, it would be regulated. It would be less crime because it's not black market. You know, a girl could report, you know, a crime committed against her rather than thinking the cop, the check bounced, huh? Well, you know, or no, rape, huh? I guess the check bounced, right? Or, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean,
absolutely. And all the fears that they have about trafficking and minors, I think those are the sort of things that prostitutes would report if they could. If, you know, I remember there was a serial rapist, and several of my friends made appointments with him. I made an appointment with him. Now, in my case, there was no violence. He just passed me a bad check. And I went immediately to the bank afterwards, and I had a feeling the check was going to bounce, and it did. And if I hadn't felt, you know, that he was an unstable human being, I would not have accepted the check, but I did.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me 3 years to finally get Oakland Police Department to take the deposition for that particular rape. 3 years, and during that time where law enforcement delayed the arrest of this serial rapist, he was not only continuing to rape, you know, service providers, but also stabbed an 18-year-old prostitute in the face with a knife.
It's pretty outrageous.
Oh, it's disgusting, and as you know, the trans women actually suffer the most violence.
Oh, absolutely, because, you know, the guys get their nut, and all of a sudden they start having buyer's remorse, and, you know, rather than deal with their own attractions, you know, they take it out on the object of their attraction.
Can we talk about that a little bit, Christine?
Sure.
I've had, now that I'm a sexologist, I sometimes get clients who are attracted to trans women, and certainly it does create a great deal of confusion for some of these men, a little bit of self-hatred, it seems, and I can only imagine what it would be like to be both the object of desire and, well, of course, most sex workers know what it's like to be the object of desire and the object of disdain simultaneously, but I would love to hear what that was like for you and maybe for the other trans women that you considered your colleagues.
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, just at the risk of psychoanalyzing, you know, people that I've never met and really just doing a lay analysis of why we have this problem of guys that are, you know, mostly heterosexual guys that are attracted to trans women, and that, but at the same time, you know, feel bad about the attraction. It's my opinion that, and I guess sexologists bear this out, that most people tend to be bisexual. However, men because of social constraints male-on-male sex, feel really guilty about that. But a trans woman kind of is like sort of in between. It's like Reese's peanut butter cups, two taste treats that taste great together. You know,
you're funny.
Montel Williams thought that. So I used that line on that show too.
Oh, did he really?
But it's kind of like if you're with a pre-op transsexual, you know, there's a penis right there, but at the same time, it's a very womanly image. So these guys can act out their bisexual, instincts, but at the same time, it's not a purely homosexual kind of. It's
right.
It's a complicated way of looking at it. Unfortunately, because of the social prescription against, one person with a penis having sex with another person with a penis, it's like, okay, they're filled with lust, they have sex, and then bam, the guilt hits. And because it's somebody with a penis, the same rules of, violence don't apply. Now, we both know that, there are some men that have got absolutely no reservations at all committing violence against a woman. But most men have no restrictions against committing violence against, somebody else with a penis. And so that's probably why trans women, especially pre-op trans women, are more likely to be facing violence. I really lucked out in the context of doing sex work in that I never had anybody beat me up. I'd been threatened. I've certainly gone through, the buyer's remorse. It's like, they get their nut and then they get this look on their face like, they just had sex with a corpse or something and they just flee, it's really not good. It wasn't great for my self-esteem to have that happen. But being 5'11", it probably made it a little less attractive for someone to try and commit violence against me because,
right. If you had been a little more slight in build, possibly.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Wow. So, that's, and I think this is actually why the police, now, do you remember Victoria Schneider?
Oh yeah, very well.
And do you remember how she was brutalized by the San Francisco police when she got arrested?
I remember that. Yeah, it was worse than that. Victoria is post-operative, which means she's got a vagina,
right.
And yet they put her into the men's side of the jail, even though she told them numerous times, "Look, I've got a vagina. I won't be safe in there."
Yeah.
And they didn't have anybody even look. They put her in there, and I think she successfully sued them for that.
She did. She got I can't remember, $250,000 or something like that.
Good for her.
In the settlement, and ended up moving to someplace. I don't know. I'm trying to remember if it was Thailand or.
I think it's someplace like Thailand.
Yeah,
she's
I'm actually looking
Facebook,
at a beautiful Asian fan that she gifted me on one of her trips back to the States. I have it right here on my windowsill. I was so proud of her. Still am.
Yeah.
So proud of her for standing up for herself and beating the San Francisco police at their own game.
Yeah, well, I mean, and really, first of all, it's not the San Francisco police. It's actually the San Francisco sheriff that runs the jails, and I say this from having been a guest there, which is also in the book.
850 Bryant?
Huh? 850, that's right. Miss 850 Bryant, as we used to call it.
850 Bryant. I have to confess I've been down there myself.
Mm-hmm. And I actually like cops.
No.
As a rule, because having spent a couple months as a guest at 850 Bryant and having lived in the Tenderloin for over 15 years, I know exactly what kind of world we would have if it weren't for cops. So, yeah, there are some real assholes, some real bad apples out there, and unfortunately some of them tend to be really conservative. There needs to be a lot of education. By the same token, I completely respect the job they do. Most people, when there's danger, you know, survival dictates that they run away from danger. The cop's job entails running to danger.
Mm.
What's that line from that movie, A Few Good Men, you know, with Tom Cruise and Demi Moore and Jack Nicholson?
Yeah,
yeah, it's like, I like them because they stand on a wall and say, no one's going to hurt you tonight.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, so that's the difference, too, in the venues that you and I worked. I worked indoors and, you know, independently for myself.
Well, so did I for the most part.
Worked independently?
I did almost all in-call, out-call.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you have some experience working the street?
Yeah, and I hated it. There are three different tiers that I've noticed, and I think these generalizations pretty much apply whether it's trans women, gay men, or genetic women, and that's that you've got the street, which is the lowest tier. It's where the prices are expected to be lowest. It's where it's supposed to be wham bam thank you, man. If a sex worker is looking to make a lot of money quickly, it's cheap. You know, they're not making as much money per date, but it's a volume business. So it's like, you know, that's why they don't want to like get hooked into a conversation. It's like, you know, they get their nut and then you're out of their car and you're out looking for another. That's also why addicts generally prefer working the street. Well, A, because the lighting's bad and you can't see if they're dope sick, you know, if they're tweaked or something.
Yeah.
But also because it's more anonymous and they can make more money really quickly if they turn volume. Then there's
now
the bar, which is a little more money. I'm
were
sorry?
You addicted?
Yeah. When I first started turning tricks out of my Spectator ad, I was mostly just smoking pot, drinking. You know, somebody had some coke, I'd do it. But about 3 months into supporting myself as a prostitute, I discovered heroin, and I discovered this marvelous ability that no matter how badly people were treating me and trying to make me feel, and no matter how scared I was or just how bad I felt about myself, all I needed to do was a little bit of heroin, and suddenly, like, life was wonderful. It's like, what did I feel bad about? Of course, then
you get addicted, and
it's a whole new problem. So.
Well, as an activist, you know, doing the television circuit as an out prostitute, one of my missions was to try to educate people that not all prostitutes are drug addicts. Myself, I had been clean and sober for 4 years. Before I ever worked in the sex industry. I'd actually gotten clean and sober while I was a college graduate and was working for a computer company. And then in sobriety, I moved on to being an office manager and a marketing representative for a radio station. Went into escorting with a totally clear head and no complications like that. So the stereotypes that abound about that, I've always, you know, really worked hard to try to counter those. Do you think that the stereotypes about that are, did they apply to your particular situation, or were there any assumptions that people made that you found kind of noxious?
Well, I wasn't turning tricks so much to pay for my habits, I was to pay my rent and cover my bills. The drugs were to deal with all of the discrimination I was facing, all of the self-loathing and so forth. I mean, I have a feeling that if I'd been more accepted, if I hadn't felt like a pariah in society, the chances are probably pretty good. I mean, I can't say this for certain, but I would have had less incentive to do heroin and some of the harder drugs because, you know, it was, heroin's a great painkiller, and it's really good for deadening emotional pain.
And that's, so that really takes us into the whole transgender issue. And so maybe before I actually ask some of these questions, you've corrected me around the word tranny. What about transgender, transsexual, trans woman? How do those things break down? Maybe also explain to the listeners what is FTM, MTF.
Sure. Well, first of all, a little disclaimer here. You stop two different trans women on the street and ask them what the difference between transgender and transsexual is, and you'll probably get two different answers. Transgender wasn't even a word when I first started out in the mid-80s, and it didn't become a community word until the early to mid-90s when we started to connect with each other on the internet, we started to have activism, we started to find our voice. And some trans women hate the word transsexual because it is associated with she-male and sex worker, and it's a heavily sexualized word. You go into an unfiltered Google search, you type transsexual, and you get page after page after page of porn sites. And so a lot of us don't like the word. On the other hand, you'll find some transsexual women that hate the word transgender because that word, in its umbrella term, transgender is a word that's often used as an umbrella to cover everybody from heterosexual cross-dressers to trans women like me, post-op transsexuals who now have a vagina. And they don't like transgender because, well, what does that mean? Are you a cross-dresser, or do you like prancing around in your wife's panties and it's a fetish? Are you someone that just does this part-time? Are you living as a woman all the time but you don't desire the surgery? I mean, what are you?
Right.
I prefer to use the word transgender in its political context, in that it covers a wide range of people that don't live in the gender with which they were born. So I personally see cross-dresser as someone that, most cross-dressers tend to be heterosexual men. A cross-dresser is someone that lives as a man, but, maybe dresses up as a woman on the weekend and goes to a certain club where there's other people like themselves. But other than that, they live as a man full time.
So transgender is the term that you prefer?
Prefer for what is the thing. I call myself a transsexual because that describes what I've been through. I went and I changed my sex via sex reassignment surgery, hormonally.
Right.
I lived as a man, and now I live full time as a woman. So I changed
my
sex socially.
So you're post-op then at this point?
Excuse me?
You're post-op?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have been for October of 2002, October 31st, actually.
And what was that like? So there was a period where you were pre-op, yes?
Oh, a long period, yes.
Yeah.
I had some health issues that I don't want to get in too much stuff because then no one's going to need to read the book if I go into too many details.
It's all in
but
the book.
Yeah, for a long time I had some health issues that kept me from getting the surgery.
Right. Right.
And I hated
and
it.
Obviously it's going to be different for everybody, but for you, was it frustrating? Or was there some fear involved in that final benchmark, if you will? Or
it was like liberation. It was the most wonderful thing I've ever done for myself. I remember when I was in the pre-op room at Eastmoreland Hospital up in Portland, Oregon, and the anesthesiologist came in and asked if I wanted something for the anxiety, and I was able to look at him and say, "What anxiety?" Man, they wheeled me into surgery. I had a big smile on my face from ear to ear.
Wow. So obviously no regrets.
Oh, God, no. And I will put it this way. I felt like, you know, when I was living as a woman full time, but I still had a penis, I felt, you know, I felt like a freak. I mean, you know, and that's not a judgment on anybody else. That's just how I felt.
Right.
I hated it. I hated, you know, being caught in the middle of this gender divide. Now, some people are perfectly happy with that. Some people are perfectly fine with identifying themselves as a woman with a penis. I never found that valid for me. You know, if someone else wants to identify that, I will acknowledge the validity of that for them, for their reality, and without judging it. I didn't buy that for myself, though. And I became asexual. I just, the idea of even masturbation, I didn't even want to touch it. I mean, I think I'm, you know, back in for a period of about a decade there, I'd masturbate maybe 5 or 6 times a year, if that. And I just wasn't interested at all. I tried to be, and it just...
You tried to what?
I tried to be interested in sex, but it's just...
It just didn't work for you.
No,
what about post-op, after the surgery? Are you very happy with the results?
I'm thrilled. Well, my website, glamazon.net, that's glamazon.net, has got photos of my post-surgical result. There is a section of the website called Transgender Information and a link there that says SRS, which stands for Sex Reassignment Surgery, and there are photos of, well, me in the hospital and in various stages of healing, and then photos of the end result. And I am out. I could pose for Hustler if I wanted, and nobody would know, just based on what my pussy looks like. I've had sex with people that they said if I hadn't told them, they wouldn't have known.
Wow.
Yeah.
For you, though? Do you, you know, obviously there's this period, I would imagine, where your arousal is, you know, kind of male-centric. Then you go through this period where you have no desire even to touch yourself. Mm-hmm. Then post-op, where you are fully female and legally so, right? You can get,
absolutely, yeah. I not too long after surgery, I filed the paperwork to have my name and sex legally changed in California.
Right. So then, what about the sexual? Was it difficult to learn how to relate sexually to your new body, or did that just feel really natural and normal, like it should have been that way all along, or have you been orgasmic? How is that?
Well, it happened almost immediately, because one of the things when you get the kind of sex change surgery that I had, which is the most common, is called penile inversion, and basically what it is they slit open the penis, they remove out all the spongy stuff that causes an erection, then they sew it up and turn it inside out like a glove, and that becomes the skin of the penis becomes the lining of the vaginal canal, and they take skin and the nerve endings from the head and form a clitoris out of that. Because this is epithelial skin, and it's not the kind of smooth muscle that a genetic woman's vaginal canal is made out of, it can actually close up like an ear piercing. It's necessary to dilate on a regular basis, and right after the surgery is when you need to dilate the most so it doesn't close up as it's healing. And so there are these Lucite dilators made out of Lucite. They look kind of like high-tech dildos, and the first one, the smallest one, is about an inch in diameter, and it was necessary 4 times a day to push that into me and hold it in place against the posterior wall of my new vagina and hold it there to just keep the skin all stretched out. And so, you know, I was penetrating myself 4 times a day that first week, and let me tell you, after the initial discomfort wore off, it's like I was supposed to just hold it there, but it was like, you know, oh, I'm going to slide this thing in and out. It's like, oh, damn, that feels good. It's like it was almost like I'd had it all along. You know, it was, I got used to it instantly.
Wow, that's amazing. That's utterly amazing. You know, of course, really, when it comes right down to it, you know, males and females really are just about inny and outy, because it's all, you know, when you're a fetus, it's all this analogous tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the distinctions that we have between men and women are pretty arbitrary.
Yeah.
And you know, that brings up another thing. What about that? Do you ever find yourself feeling impatient with how gendered our culture is, and how people, you know, sometimes have a hard time seeing the person because they're so busy trying to figure out if it's a boy or a girl? Or has that ever been an irritation for you, or do you find that that's kind of how you look at life too? Or
well, personally, to quote Kate Bornstein, you know, gender can be a battleground or a playground. Gender, you can have a lot of fun with gender. But unfortunately, for better or for worse, most people see gender in a very binary sort of way. Some people can count genders higher than, you know, higher than two. If you look at it sociologically, because we do live in a gendered society, because men and women are not treated the same, related to each other the same, for sociological reasons, for sexual reasons, and so forth, when you meet somebody for the first time, your brain is subconsciously assigning a gender to them just based on visual clues, how their voice sounds, and mannerisms, and so forth. Because a person's gender is to some degree going to dictate how you relate to that person. And that, I think that's just human nature. I think it's only a problem when you treat somebody differently, you know, from one gender to another, if you treat them differently in a bad way. You know, if it's like, well, the person's a woman, so you're immediately going to treat them like an object and not take them seriously and, belittle them or whatever, then that's clearly not a good thing. But I think that...
So has that happened for you? Have you found that people are more sexist or dismissive of you now that you're a woman than they might have been when you were a man?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's frustrating. And all I can do is just, you know, well, for instance, for, you know, my work, I'm a software engineer, and I just strive to be the best that I can. And, you know, how does the saying go? A woman has to do twice as good a job as a man to be taken half as seriously. But
this is applying to your life, even though you started off as a man. That's you're living in that world too.
Uh huh.
Unbelievable.
Exactly. Well, and first of all, I keep hearing an argument from some separatist feminists or radical feminists who say that, well, you can never be a woman because you've never had the female experience and you've had male privilege. And well, first of all, you haven't been with me in the step of the way, so you don't know what kind of privilege I may or may not have experienced.
Right.
The male privilege is not this homogenous kind of like, well, you're born with a penis, therefore you've got this kind of privilege. You ask any male of color, you know, about what kind of privilege they've had. I was not your typical male growing up. I was, I guess you can call me a sissy or whatever. I was beat up a lot. I was, you know, scared of my own shadow. I didn't socialize well. The only, you know, the only one I discovered pot was I was able to relate to other people. So I don't think I didn't have the same male privilege, say, that Arnold Schwarzenegger had, or most men.
Right.
So, it's...
Absolutely. So, and what about that? Is that, as far as, like, the getting beat up, now, does that happen now, or is that a form of harassment that is no longer a part of your life?
Well, you know, being 5'11", most bullies tend to be cowards, and they're not going to, you know, go after somebody that might put up a fight, even if that somebody is wearing a skirt. Number two, and I found this out, you know, having lived in the Tenderloin, which, as you know, is a very bad, dangerous neighborhood, if you're walking around and you project an air of self-confidence that, you know, that nobody's going to, you know, that you can take care of yourself, you're going to, you know, give off those vibes, and people are going to be less likely to mess with you. And people that walk with confidence, plus people that are obviously aware of their surroundings, are much less likely to get picked on. So, you know, I generally, I don't know if it's having been in the military or not, but I generally walk with confidence, and I am aware of my surroundings, and it's very rare that I've ever felt really threatened. So I've been blessed, I guess, in that sense.
So getting beat up must have been what happened to you when you were younger.
Exactly, yeah, in high school, absolutely.
Yeah, high school, yeah. Well, what about love? What about that, Christine? Well, you and I are catching up here. I mean, how's your love life? Are you in love? I know when I met you 20 years ago, you had a beautiful blonde girlfriend who also, I think, played guitar in your band.
Well, actually, no, that was actually 2 years after we met. We met in 91, right after Samantha asked me to join the Coyote steering committee. And
uh-huh.
I was unhappily single at that time, and I think I was pretty shamelessly hitting on you, as I recall.
Pretty what?
I was pretty shamelessly hitting on you, as I recall.
You hit on a lot of people, though.
Well, mostly you and Samantha.
You're so sweet.
It wasn't so much, well, I wanted to get laid. I wanted a girlfriend. I wanted to be in love. Sex is all good and wonderful, but if I ever had a choice between, okay, well, you can be with this, you know, you can be with somebody, you can either have wonderful sex for the rest of your life, or you can, you know, just be in love and I could have cuddling or sex. I would take cuddling and not look back.
Yeah.
I would take the affection and not look back.
Make a choice like that, but I understand exactly what you're saying.
And that's what I wanted back then. You know, I still want it. I was in sort of a relationship. Oh, I've been really unlucky ever since I left Renata. And Renata and I weren't really in a romantic relationship. We had our band together, and we were really affectionate and roommates, but we weren't having sex. We were just, you know, we were really affectionate. We were like sisters that slept in the same bed, but, you know, we had our band. That was what we had together. Before my last one, I was with this woman who, you know, turned out to be married. I mean, she wasn't legally married, but, you know, she might as well have been to this person. And the other one, the one who was married, I just haven't been very fortunate. So now it's just me and my kitty cats, and that's the way I want it right now.
It's just you and your kitty cat?
My kitty cats. I love my cats. They're like my babies.
Okay, well, so you're ordinarily I would say you were batching it because lots of girls talk that way. But I don't know. If you're a trans woman, do you take umbrage at a term like that?
Batching it? No,
yeah.
Not really. Because
being
a
bachelor, you know.
Bachelorette, okay. I mean, you know, it's like dude. It's like, you know, people have been saying dude to me for a decade now, and
girls nowadays don't actually refer to themselves in female gender. It is about dude.
Yeah. I'm comfortable enough and secure enough in my gender to be called dude, to be batching it. Yeah, I'm far too busy. I mean, I've been working on my book for the last year, and now I'm promoting it. And when I've got the promotion to a certain point, I'm getting back to editing this novel I'm working on. I've got some screenplays I want to get back to rewriting. I've got guitar to be played. You know, it's like I'm too busy for a relationship right now.
Oh, so fine. I definitely think we got to find you somebody.
Oh, that's
a good question. Now, would you be looking for a girlfriend or a boyfriend?
Oh God, definitely a girlfriend. I mean, you can't be, you know, a prostitute and enjoy your job the way I mostly did and not be at least a Kinsey 4 or a 5, you know? but you know, sex with men, with some men, it can be fun. It can be enjoyable. But I have never, ever been in love with a man in my life.
That's very interesting because that's how I feel about sex with women. It can be fun and it can be interesting, but I've never been in love with a woman.
Mm-hmm. You just haven't met the right woman.
Oh, don't even go there.
Well, maybe what you need to find is a trans woman. See, then you get to have the best of both. It's
both
energies going on there, and you know, it could happen.
Anything's possible.
Yep.
Anything's possible.
I think that in terms of who I'd want, it would have to be. Well, I definitely want to be with another woman. I wouldn't rule out another trans woman. I wouldn't rule that out. The important thing is that she, you know, be smart and funny, and if not in recovery, at least sane, you know, and not an addict. And
we should say that we read all the CD salacious stuff from the blurb about your book, but at this point in your life now, you got a day job. You've been out of prostitution for how long?
Since 86, pretty much. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, when I went back to trying to live as a man, I left that whole thing behind because women aren't paying for sex. And I, for a brief period in 85, I worked as an escort agency as a guy because I desperately needed the money. You know, I needed to pay for hormones and everything, and electrolysis. And that was one way, but I hated it. I couldn't, when my boobs finally started to come in from the hormones, I got away from working as a male escort. And I could never see going back to that. Since 89, I've had this great corporate job. I mean, doing the software engineer, and I wouldn't do anything to risk that, including an arrest for prostitution. So,
what year did you get clean and sober?
I'm sorry.
What year did you get clean and sober?
Well, I kicked heroin the first time and got clean and sober in 88, and then. Well, you and I met in 91. I was about 3 years.
Yeah.
And then I got into this nightmare relationship from hell in 92, and I relapsed, and I came back briefly and went out again and just drank. I convinced myself, well, you're a heroin addict. You're not an alcoholic. And so I proceeded to drink like an alcoholic for 3.5 years. And finally I had to, 97, I've been clean and sober since 97.
Right on.
14
right on.
Years, yep.
Yes,
and I
yes.
quit smoking 8 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Quit smoking cigarettes or pot?
Everything. Well, I've been clean and sober since 97,
so no
cigarettes
pot.
was the only drug that was left for me. Well, unless you count, caffeine. But.
Right on. Well, I just recently saw you. You look fabulous. Take very good care of
yourself. As do you, my dear.
Thank you.
important question that I've been dying to ask you.
Okay, but I don't know if we got time to answer because we're really out of time. What's the question, sweetheart?
What are you wearing right now?
Oh, shut up.
If I ever write a memoir about sex work, I'm going to entitle the book, What Are You Wearing Right Now? And I think
I
both know what that question means.
I like that.
It means they're jacking off. They got no intention of buying your services.
That's right. It's time for dial tone. So I have to sign off here, but before we go, tell the listeners one more time how they can get their copy of Not Your Average American Girl.
Well, the easiest way to get there would be go directly to my website, because there's less to write down. That's glamazon.net. Just think of glamorous Amazon, glamazon.net. Or if you want to go, you can go to Glamazon Press, all one word, glamazonpress.com. So either will get you right to the book.
Ah, fabulous. Thank you, sweetheart. I love your guts. Thank you for joining me on the Shame Free Zone.
It has been so much fun, and I can't wait. We got to do a slumber party at Put Sam's.
Okay, it's a date. Definitely. And for my listeners, just to let you know, next week I'm going to be interviewing Kathy Labriola. She's joining us this time to talk about bisexuality. So if you have any questions about whether you may be bisexual or whether a friend of yours might be sure and tune in next Monday at 9. That's it from the Shame Free Zone. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak menutup kabar berita?